The Big Red Couch, a podcast about making role-playing games. A group of GMs and players draw ideas from the mystery box and bring their game pitches to you.
Welcome to the Big Red Couch. Today's card reads, Supermax Kindergarten, for all the master criminal children. That's episode 59, and we've got a guest host, John Ryer, to help us unpick this knotty early education issue.
Well, thank you very much. Gotta have a call back to the previous episode somewhere.
Oh, yeah. You've already listened to it? Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent.
He commented within a few hours of the thing dropping. It was actually a little spooky.
Indeed. I'll get the chalkboard and mark another tally next to our website.
We are in Sesquatch Bunch here in podcast land, so yes.
It's true. If you didn't listen to podcasts, you wouldn't make a podcast unless you're a special kind of sociopath.
Mm. Hey, speaking of podcasts, thank you, John, for agreeing to come onto this thing and taking time from hosting on not one but two podcasts out there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm well-versed with people spread across the world. The folks know on the Tritech Games podcast. Shall I plug it?
Oh, please. Go ahead. We are always happy to sell out to Big Polyhedra.
Yeah, so the Tritech Games podcast, we do a weekly podcast. The website is tritechsystems.podbeam.com. That's tritechsystems.podbeam.com. That really is our shill podcast. We basically, we're the mouthpiece for Tritech Games. We do try to make it such that we make our podcast about things that cover more other games. We recently talked about adding anime tropes to your game. So if you want to play an anime-based game, the things to look out for, you know, and what to worry about. And yeah, it's three parts. Each part's about 45 minutes each.
Okay. That's a lot of anime.
Oh, yeah, and that's cut down from the original 3 hours.
Oh, that's an endurance podcast. Don't you?
Oh, yeah, when we do that session, basically we start and we go until we run out. And that can go as little as an hour and a half, as much as 3 hours. So, yeah.
Okay, so you basically just hit record and run until you've covered everything and...
Until the mouth stops working. Yeah.
And it's cool. The focus is the Tritech Games products and so forth.
Yeah, but we also talk about various ideas and concepts and so forth. We did an episode, a couple episodes on motivations for your character that come from within rather than from without. You know, basically your character's drives and what they're looking for. And we just did an entire episode on that. So giving you pointers on how to basically work out what your character is, and I'm a firm believer in creating plot hooks for my GM with my character. So instead of just creating an adventure that's from a book, he can create an adventure from my character.
Nice, easily labeled levers for the GM to, mm-hmm. to haul on. Nice.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, this is after years of, you know, role-playing and working on games and designing games and designing games that never got published. But, you know, you learn these things. And of course, the other podcast I'm on is, of course, the same one with Taz is the Sunday Skypers. That's sundayskypers.podbean.com. And we've been having fun with that group. This is how incestuous this is. We started that group based on a splinter group from the Gutter Skypes. So the Gutter Skypes spawned Monkeys Took My Jetpack. Monkeys Took My Jetpack spawned us, Sunday Skypers.
It's a whole family tree thing.
That is bizarre. Yeah.
And we have people from all three podcasts on all three podcasts.
And have you spawned any podcasts of your own yet? You know, is there a cast out there that is the great grandchild of the Gutter Skypes? Or...
We haven't heard of that yet. We don't know. You never know. We can cross-pollinate. I know you've been cross-pollinated at least three times now.
That's true, yeah. It is a very weird space, the RPG podcast space. I have come to slowly understand.
Yeah, and I also got to remember there's a cross-pollination across between Gutter Skypes and All Games Considered. That's through Mr. K. The benefit of Mr. K. But yeah, I would love to invite you guys over for a game, but trouble is one of our GMs, Wilhelm, is in Sweden. When we game, it's his evening. It's his late afternoon. And we're doing it early in the morning.
And we are asleep.
And he does the Sunday afternoon, but he starts at 1, and he usually gets done by about now. I think we'd be hard pressed to actually somehow rope him in for a game.
It would be tricky, yes. Yes,
it is midnight.
That is something that we have noticed. If we ever get a guest from the UK or anywhere in Europe, the time frame is going to be just because, just because of the joys of time zones.
Oh yeah, for me it's fun. I get up at 7 o'clock in the morning on Sundays, so I can then make the 8 o'clock start time for the Sunday Skypers.
Wow.
You know, yeah. The United States is big enough that you know there's a 3 hour time difference. You know.
Yeah.
For Todd, it's 10 o'clock, and I think for someone else, it's 11 o'clock. So they got plenty of time to get up in the morning and do stuff. And you know? Me, I got to get up and go bam on the computer. Well, I do that anyway. Well, no. To be honest, I'd be up by 7 anyway. It's just the way my brain's now wired.
Not wired for sleeping in.
Well, if I sleep in, it means I'm sick.
Right.
It's cool to hear that Tritech is doing a podcast presentation to help people hear about their stuff and help play the game better and more satisfyingly. One of my impressions from back in the day, White Wolf's case as well, but the White Dwarf, the Games Workshop's house organ, started out as being a really, we like to play games, here is a Warhammer scenario, here is a Warhammer 40k scenario, here are stats and stuff for another game producer's game. And it was all quite lovey-dovey. Sometime later, about the time I went, I can no longer afford this game, it turned into a pressed sheet of rules and adverts specifically for them. I think it lost something there. I mean, Even the higher echelons of role-playing is still kind of a hobby business. It's on that scale, but some places in the outer reaches, it gets a little less communal and people don't share quite as much, which was, I think, something that they lost. But I guess they made gleams of money, so they're probably happy with that.
Yeah, unless you're Fred Hicks, Morningstar, or Jackson, you're not going to make a living at this job.
No, I'm... From what I've heard from various sort of roundtable recordings and things, I'm pretty sure that the people who make money doing role-playing games do it because they do a lot of stuff anyway. So, it's there aren't any role-playing billionaires out there. I'm pretty sure of that.
No.
And I think it's the passion. I think it's yourself doing all of these different things. It's that people are throwing themselves into this and doing a lot of just putting a lot of energy into it, which I think is awesome. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. What I love to call the fame and fortune contract most game designers get. You'll be famous if you're fortunate enough to get your name in the book.
I remember somebody's comment that game design is one of those industries where people will spend years aiming for dizzy heights of McDonald's weight. And that's how you can tell when you've made it.
But this in this day and age, this is the day and age of Patreon. Fate's doing it. Fate's running a Patreon to finance the development of various game modules. Then as a Patreon patron, you get for free, but you're paying them. I'm paying like 10 bucks a month, and that adds up, And if they get 1,000 people, 10 bucks, 1,000 people, that's $10,000 a month.
True. That bar to actually still be able to produce and distribute things has been lowered via technology so that you don't have to do a print run of thousands. And I've heard things about, the production costs and the availability of software and so forth to do layout and books and so forth. A lot of the thing they talk about when they discuss, when some of the people who are intimately involved in the industry talk about this thing, it's this is how not to lose your shirt and your pants and your house.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like Patreon's another means of getting in contact with people who want to see what you're putting out and allowing them to pay your way rather than just sort of flinging something out into the world that might just fall back and crush you.
Yeah. Yeah. When the other patron, I'll plug him because I like his work, is Josh Roby. He's doing a Patreon for his Ports of Call game. Basically, he does these little adventures set in a steampunk world that you can then pick up and use, and patrons like myself can dictate what the next Port of Call is going to be. The next one is going to be Chichen Itza in the Mayan country.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And is a Patreon is, well, Patreon Josh Roby, JOSHROBY. I'm just going to push it. He's not making a whole lot. He's only making like 83 bucks a month for this. But yeah, if I can get a few more people joining up and helping him out, that'd be great. I'm also a Patreon for a couple who are making good money. Are you familiar with the Dresden Kodak webcomic?
I am.
Mm-hmm.
And right now he's making $4,000 an issue.
Whoa. That's not bad. Wow. That's pretty impressive.
A webcomic.
Yeah, in webcomic country, that's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it basically has a living wage. I mean, that's more than a living wage. It's enough that he actually can hire a minion, which we call the Dark Minion. But, you know.
Nice. As it should be. The goal of everybody to have their own minion.
Well, Patreon is good, but a lot of people look at this sort of thing and sort of say, oh, you're making thousands and thousands of... It produces a bit of expectation out of people. Also, since folks... That is the amount of money before tax, and after some people have accidentally cancelled their credit cards or kind of reneged on what they're doing. I mean, it's a good number to look at and say, that's doing pretty well, but the reality is quite scary. And I'm fairly impressed by anyone who's going out there in the first place and saying, look at me, I'm great, pay me money.
And Patreon gets like a 2% cut. 2-3% cut of that. So it's not exactly 4,000, but yeah. I back several of them because there's people I really like and I want to see more of the work. Some folks have actually stopped. For one, I'm not going to mention which one is, but he basically got a full-time job as an artist. So he's pretty much stopped his Patreon, which I'd like, which was a good idea. He then said, I will have no time for my webcomic, which you've been paying for, but I'm going to be a nice guy and stop it. And it's at such a time this job goes away, webcomic's in hiatus, you know, basically.
Some nice clear communication as to what the hell's going on.
Mm-hmm. And just an act of love. I don't suppose you ever heard of a website called the Atomic Rocket website.
That rings a bell, actually.
Well, yeah, it's kind of famous because it's run by Winchell Chung. Now, that's
where it's from. Okay.
For you youngin' out there who don't know, Winchell Chung is the person who designed and drew the first Ogre tank for Ogre.
Ah, it's right.
That Winchell Chung, he's basically run a Patreon to pay for him to basically upkeep his website. And part of what he's using that money for is to basically pay him, one, for his time to do this. Because, if I was getting paid to write, I'd be paying about $35 an hour.
That is never going to happen in the RPG space.
No. Though I do like the fact that a lot of folks are doing these things. I like the fake codec is also on Patreon. But that one is paying for the artwork. They're actually paying their artists.
Hmm.
Yeah, because if you think game designers don't get paid well... Either the game artist gets paid fantastically well, or it's basically exposure for your work.
Yeah.
That old game.
Try paying your rent with exposure. Yeah, I know that one, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things where... But the thing is, I'm thinking about once I get... Because I've been working on the Savage Worlds adaptation of our Fringeworthy game, and it's been interesting. Gone through many revisions. One thing I want to do... is actually have it professionally edited. Now, I've talked to, I work in the industry, I'm a technical writer by trade, so I work in the industry a bit, so I've talked to people who actually freelance as editors, and I told them I have a 200-plus, 100,000-word book, and they all start quoting prices in the $12,000 range.
As time is money, and their time is worth that much money.
Holy and this crap. Is not... And this is not for a copy edit. This is for an edit. Mm. For proper, grammar. What is the purpose of this paragraph edit? One of the things that... Yes. Well, the thing is, most edits these days are done by the guy's wife or their best friend. Or they pass it out to all their friends and they basically take the average of the edits and say, this is good.
With technical writing, an unclear or unnecessary part of a role-playing book... is just a giant hole waiting for the water to rush in and sink the whole ship.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, what is Fringeworthy?
Oh, okay. Well, the elevator pitch is a race of alternate beings from another Earth built this giant network of gates between alternate worlds. And it seems that one person in 100,000 has an ability to make use of these gateways. And the colloquial name for them is Fringeworthy, which is where you get the title of the game. The long, more involved version of the description is you're basically a team of explorers. You nominally work for the United Nations. You actually work for your countries, but then you work for this non-governmental organization called the United Nations Interdimensional Agency or Authority, which depending, I'm going back and forth in that name, the UNIDA. And you're going out and you're investigating this artifact, more or less. You're going down these pathways and checking out these alternate worlds. Some of the gates don't lead to alternate worlds. They lead to other places in the solar system. Oh, wow, I can go to Mars by riding a bicycle. Or you can go to the stars, it seems. There are portals that lead to stars in our galaxy, in this universe of ours. And you can go to other worlds where there's other people. Currently, we have... They're all humans, or at least all from Earth. We have the Victorians. We have... They're called the Erders, but they come from an Earth that's about 1.3 times the size of Earth. So it has a higher gravity, so they're heavy worlders. It's definitely a parallel world because the continents are exactly the same, even though the world's bigger. Go figure. There's one where there was a plague and wiped everybody except the folks up in the Scandinavian countries, and they survived. Those are the Aerithers. We also have the Mongols. We have the Pax Romana. Romans. Yay, Romans in the 15th century. That's a show in itself, which I think we've already done in our podcast. Well, having Rome last until the 15th century, we're talking Western Rome, and it's recognizably Rome, is alien space bats.
Yeah.
It can't happen, but we have to make it happen. The big difference, the first emperor of Rome was not Octavian Caesar, otherwise known as Augustus Caesar. It was a Thracian by the name of Spartacus.
It's a bit of an upset.
Yeah. As for the non-humans, there's the Blizniz, who are a bunch of empathic baby elephants who have the ability to, we call it the cool chill man, chill ability. And make you peaceful when you're around them and, you know, chill. Well, actually, more like, chill. Because they're elephants, you know, they got a long nose. The Tzeel, they're a reptilian race. When they find the portal, it's in a temple. And it turns out the high priests and priests are all fringeworthy. Of course, the only way you can become a priest is if you can actually enter the portal. So there's a whole bunch of fringery right there. And there's actually more about this. This is going to come out in the future podcast, so I'm not going to spoil it for that podcast. So. There's the Demixi, something of horrors for most people. They're giant spiders. Yeah, they see giant spiders on a world that they've polluted to the point where it's actually in early stages of Venusification.
And there's something of a wrinkle to the transport across the fringe paths as well?
Yes, electrical devices don't work. Barriers are discharged, whether or not they're hooked up or not. Nuclear materials, well, anything of physical potential, that's the best way to put it, gets turned into non-physical isotopes. Someone has worked out how much power that releases and says, my God, that's a lot of zeros.
On the other hand, provides you a fantastic way of dealing with...
Yep. Yeah. What else is about the physical thing? Oh, yeah. And everything's 72 kilometers away. We have nodes. There are four basic nodes, prime, alternate, system, and stellar. But stellar then hooks up to another 8 nodes for individual star systems. So prime is basically the 8 portals on the prime platform connect to different places on Earth, usually in far away, inconvenient places on Earth, you know, like under the ice in Antarctica, in the middle of the mountains in Siberia, in the middle of the Verbena Sand Sea in Libya, under the sea near Japan.
Wildly inconvenient places.
Yep, wildly inconvenient places. Yep, and then they connect. Then the Ultra platform has 8 portals that can lead to mostly alternate worlds of the prime world. That's the rule. Now, when I look at the stuff that Richard's put out, he never follows that rule, but I would say I'm leaving things open. Richard Tohoka, the designer of the original game, but I'm changing that. In fact, I'm not defining anything. I'm only defining portals that are open. I'm leaving the ones that are not open undefined so the GM can create his own world behind that portal, leaving room for GM creation. System, the everything there leads to different places in the solar system. There are at least 2 that go to Mars. There are none that go to the moon, interesting enough. So, go figure. Yeah. Stellar Hub, I forget what the stars are, but they're all within 40 light years of Earth. And they all, at least one leads to a planet. Whether or not it's terrestrial, that's up to the GM. I'm going to leave those circles up to the GM. And then The Eldritch platform is connected to other nodes on either side of it. So basically you have this very long, a million, million worlds, as we say, or a million, million nodes, or more. You never know. It depends on how the GM wants to run a game. Yeah, and each one of these platforms are 79 kilometers apart, or 49 miles for those who still use the Imperial units.
So you can expect to do a lot of walking or cycling.
Well, no. Well, diesel engines still work because they don't require electronics. Mm. But, of course, we're talking diesel engines before they were electronified. So you're talking stuff from the late 60s earlier.
Yeah, diesel or steam, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Victorians make use of, I'm calling Victorians, even though they call themselves British subjects. The Victorians make use of steam lorries and stuff like that, and steam vehicles, all custom built. The Earth Prime. Oh, yeah. I had fun because I decided, okay, they're based in Alice Springs. That's where the main training base is, and that's where headquarters is in Alice Springs. So they need a diesel vehicle. And I said, what is an old diesel vehicle that would be available in Australia? And I started looking around. It's a diesel lorry that was built in great quantities. The Austin FG K100. It's basically was the workhorse of the British Empire. What would you have chosen? I'm just out of curiosity.
I hadn't gone quite that big. I was imagining the classic old Land Rover.
Oh,
Leland, I think.
Well, that would work too. Yes, the old classic diesel. You know, now they all have to be retrofitted either with a crank start. And in fact, the old FGs were crank started.
True, because once you get to
Yeah, though I did have the boffins do think, you know, I love using those terms, you know, boffins. But yeah, who basically retrofitted, you know, they said, okay, crank start or, and they put in an air tank system and a little air turbine to work as a starter motor.
Nice.
You know, another one, they decided to take a tip of the hat from the old starting system for airplanes, the cartridge system, basic explosive cartridges that would then spin a turbine and turn the engine over.
As seen you know, on the movie.
Yes.
Plane crashed in the desert. Yeah.
They had used cartridges from a salvage aircraft. And of course, the wind up, where it's a crank, but instead of cranking, you're winding up a spring, detaching the thing, and then you're letting the spring unwind and let it do all the turning, and you won't get your, you know, break your hands as the engine starts and kicks it backwards at you.
Nice.
Which, yep. Oh, yes. The players, when they visited Victorian Prime, they were able to get a hold of a steam bus from England. And they were more or less told, don't scratch it. It's 100 years old.
Do not break.
Yeah. We have to return it intact. So, of course, you know what happened to it? It got shot in half. And the Victorians... Yes, and the Victorians gladly fixed it for him, but, you know, it doesn't quite match. And they fixed the engine because the engine was just, you know, bloody, it was, you know, inefficient steam engine.
So naturally they fixed it better.
Yeah, they fixed it. Yeah, better. Yeah. So they don't have to, you know, because one of the problems was you go 79 kilometers, stop, shovel the ashes out. Then you go another 70 kilometers and shovel the ashes because it was coal fired. I actually found it on the webs and said, oh yeah, so it's a coal fired steam lorry up someplace in the Hebrides.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I am now imagining the little London double decker bus going along the fringe paths, but I'm not sure how high they are.
It actually was double deckered.
Oh wow, oh, sweet. Okay.
If you're going to put a boiler on something, you might as well have two decks of passengers.
Yeah. The other vehicle came with the original game. The very first version of Fringeworthy. Richard included what was called the Muscovy. Well, there is no such thing as a Muscovy, but we made one. I actually have wonderful pictures of it. I actually found it was the BRDM, and I did some photo manipulations on it to change it into this personnel carrier. It's a diesel Russian vehicle. So, yeah, you know, it didn't work well in the Russian winters.
No.
No, in fact, I researched this. I went looking at every Russian six-wheeled vehicle. They all were gasoline-powered. Every single one of them. Not a single diesel in the bunch. So I looked and said, okay, this was built. And then I realized it just didn't work. So they ended up selling it to all the other, you know, countries. So basically, the versions they are using in the game are from Cuba and Vietnam.
The export, as it were.
Yep. And they're all amphibious, because whenever the Russians make a personal vehicle, it's amphibious, because of all the damn rivers they have to cross. But yeah, the game is about exploration. Where I'm working at right now in the Savage Worlds version is that you're still working for your country, but you're in this organization working with other people from around the world. And because it is totally random, it's an interesting system, and you explore it, and there are some dangers. I hate to give away too much, but you know, I'm also of opinion that if you sell the rule book intact, and unless you provide a player's guide, the players also buy the rule book, which means they get to thumb through and look, oh, look at this secret we're not supposed to know. Basically, the people who built this are still around the system. They're called the Termelin, and they look like, they either look like giant intelligent weasels or giant intelligent bear dogs. Just depends on the artist who's drawing them. Considering that canines and bears actually have a common ancestor, the bear dog is probably the better of the two choices. Basically, they developed this a million years ago. They became intelligent about the same time apes gained sentience. Earth Prime is actually time retarded. That is, we're a million years younger, so to speak. You know, so when they first were, building the fringe platforms, they were in their equivalent of, say, the 2100s, when we were a million years ago. So we're a million years behind in time because they were humans. They met humans along the way. So there are humans who are a million years older than us out there from places called New York.
Those parallel.
Yeah. Yeah, parallel worlds and alternate worlds and time retarded worlds and all those fun things and the pocket universes and critters called the Meller. Do I want to talk about the Mellers? They were an emissary of theirs that went bad in a very bad way. And that's why I'm just going to leave it.
Fair enough.
Spoilers.
You got to keep some secrets.
Yeah. Now I am using Savage Worlds. One has gone through, like I said, it's gone through many revisions. I actually had a completely unique psionics system in it, and I went and looked at it and said, "What the hell are you doing?" and just ripped it out. Because it literally was, "What the hell were you doing with that sucker?" Making something way too complex, and I realized, no, you make it more complex, it's very unlikely anyone will use it. So basically, I'm just defaulting to the standard psionics and Savage Worlds, but I've added some extra powers because I looked and said, you don't actually have these powers defined. So here, you know, like, there's no telepathy in Savage Worlds.
That's half the fun of a psionics system is,
yeah.
is telepathy, yeah. They don't invent the wheel, just tweak the bits of it that eat. Yeah.
Add rooms.
Exactly. This is the Google Drive folder it's resting on right now. Open to the public. People can go and comment and look at it. Download the copy. It is a slightly formidable size for reading, but yeah. I decided not to include the Savage Worlds rules again because I went and looked at the other world books that have been out there. And then I realized, okay, I don't actually need to repeat all the rules. I just need to tell you what the difference is from those rules. You know, so you will need Savage Worlds Deluxe to play this. Yeah, and I would love the people to go take a look at it. Now, it is a Word doc, so if you do a comment, it will not tag the comment to what you were commenting on, which I hate.
Yeah. So it's just a free book. yeah, that's going to make editing or assimilating a little bit more interesting, isn't it?
So, folks, if you do comment, just mention, on page so-and-so. So at least I have an idea. I did page number. Did page them. And there's a working table of contents. There is not a working index. So I figure that's what we're going to do last.
Once everything else is sorted and you know where the page... No. Nobody wants to have the White Wolf page XX problem.
If I do reference the Savage Worlds Deluxe book, because the PDF is different from the printed book, different from the new PDF, there's three versions now. In page count, I would just reference the section with no page reference. You have to look at the table of contents to figure out where it is. This is just one of the few things I've worked on. We originally did a D20 version of both Bureau 13, Stalk Unite Fantastic, and of Fringeworthy. D20 called OGL, but at the time it was D20, and OGL wasn't really viable. Now OGL is viable, but we still call it D20. Figure. And it's a highly adaptable Pathfinder. If you listen to my co-host Trav, on the Tri-Tech podcast, so it works.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. Anything else could I pontificate upon? in keeping with our theme about super villains and so forth, I've been working on actually my own Fate superhero game.
Oh, awesome. lay on.
I'm using Fate Accelerated because I'm a purist because I've been reading comics for many years.
Shocking.
Yeah, but I'm harking my version, which is based on a campaign, a shared campaign our local gaming group here plays. Shocking. So someone's made a role playing game based on a local campaign.
This has never happened before in the history of the industry.
Never. Yeah, my friend Laura Morgenstern, she's a teacher, but she came up with this thing called Harbor City. It's basically set in the Mystery Men universe, only it's not in the Mystery Men universe.
For legal reasons, it's not in the Mystery Men universe.
yeah. But it's basically in the Mystery Men universe. It's also in the Marvel universe and the DC. It's one of those little bastardized, you can talk about the Joker and Batman as though they're real people.
Cool.
But it's harking back to the very first superhero role-playing game. This is a quiz time. Do you know what the very first superhero role-playing game is?
Oh, see, part of me wants to say Champions, but that's just because it's the first one I ran into.
Marvel Superheroes was the one I ran into first. I certainly hope it isn't Superhero Squadron, because that was ghastly.
I'm guessing that's two wrong answers from the Grid Couch team. Which, to be fair, fits in entirely with our market positioning as people who don't really know what we're talking about. So, technically, we're still on message.
Yeah, and sadly, I can say I played the original first edition when it came out back in 1979.
I see.
Superhero 2044.
I have not heard of that.
Neither have I, but that shouldn't surprise any of our audience.
It's still available from Game Science. From the man, Lou Zachi, a name to conjure with. And of course, for those of you who have no idea, Lou Zachi was the guy who brought dice to the gamers. He was first and foremost famous for his dice. He produced all the different kinds of polyhedral dice we are now familiar with in the game. He also produced the D30.
Yep. And smuggled it into the world, disguising it as educational aids.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Look, it's for maths.
And he created the D100.
Ah, the D100. Wonderful dice. Never stop rolling. Never.
Well, he said, you got to roll in a box.
Mm.
And eventually the lead pellet inside will finally roll into a pit and stop it. And then you got to sit there and look directly over the top to determine, okay, what number is on top?
Yes, it's possibly the only model of dice that required some very accurate surveying equipment to be able to determine what the hell had happened.
It was one of those games from someone's campaign. They made their homebrewed superhero game, and it really shows in a lot of the in-jokes in the game. But what made it infamous and famous at the same time was that it had no skills and it had no superpowers defined. It was between you and your GM.
Ah, that is a very early appearance of a gaming innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, we're still at that point emerging from the swamp of tabletop miniatures war games. So yeah, anything was going.
Now, sadly, that was his only innovation. You could tell by looking at it's an early RPG because it had so many stats and so many calculations.
Distances and inches.
No. It was horrendous. It wasn't playable. It's one of those games where you needed the game designer there with you to explain, and this is how this is supposed to work, not right. What I wrote.
Oh.
Yeah, that is the art of game design, or at least that is what people have correctly identified is the true wisdom in game design, making sure that you don't have to be in the room for the game to work.
Mm-hmm. This is why I firmly believe in blind playtesting. In fact, if anyone does play, you know, the rules as written right now for Sarah's Fringeworthy are complete enough that you actually can run a game. And I want people to do that and let me know what didn't work and did work so I can then fix it. I
mean, what they had problems with.
One of the things I ran into with a couple of groups was that I'm starting to realize that running adventures for games doesn't really work because it's not tied to the players. And I'm a firm believer in player agency these days, where the players get a chance to put something into the world as well as you, the GM. You know, don't be afraid of the player make stuff up because it works. You know, it means they're more involved.
You can create settings, but that the people can interact with, and so you've got something to refer to. But telling people what to do, or just basically creating like a programmatic flowchart of the events,
So what I want to do is put in sandboxes. It's basically a world description. It gives you enough information and plot hooks that you, the GM, can then take those bits of information and make your own adventure.
Let the players loose and see what happens, yes.
Oh, yeah, because I have a couple of adventures I actually had written up. And when I ran them, I ran like three times, and they ran three different ways every time. They were never the same. They kept going off in different directions. And I started to realize, maybe I should just write this as a sandbox and let them do that. Let the GM decide which way things are going to go, and then he can decide what happens. Because, to be honest, it makes my life a lot easier then. It does, because one of the complaints I got for one game was that we need more information based on the scenario. There's not enough information. I'm going, okay, but if I start doing that, I might as well start writing the world book for this world at that point.
That wonderful balancing act, yeah.
They call me Captain Tangent. So the loop back, to Harbor City, the thing I've done in there is that there are no superpowers defined. And in my little notes there, I point out the fact that you can't really define how superpowers work. I mean, when I was following Spider-Man way back when, this is back in the 80s and late 90s, I was actually a Marvel zombie. And in one issue, Spider-Man has a hard time picking up a Volkswagen Rabbit. Three issues later, he's one-handing a truck, you know. And in one issue, he's constantly running out of juice for his web shooters. Next one down, he's like, they're not even mentioned, and he's webbing up everything everywhere. There's no consistency.
Is there particular things you've done to try and encourage that flavor and keep that sort of homage going?
Well, one thing I did was I introduced the ideas of ranks. When you're playing this game, are you playing a bunch of D-listers? Are you playing B-listers? Are you playing A-listers? Are you playing legendaries?
So describing the scope of the experience you're going to see.
Yeah. If you're playing a bunch of mystery men, you're playing D-listers. I did introduce one unique feature. If you're familiar with Fate, you have stunts. I was looking at it saying, okay, but you never get enough points. And I wanted legendaries to be, well, legendary. Then I realized they need a very special stunt. I call it the hero stunt. Basically, you get a +1 per stunt slot, but it only works when you use your superpowers.
Interesting. The more stunt slots. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's pretty legendary.
Yeah. If for a legendary, it's 6 slots. That's a +6 if you want to put all on your hero stunt.
And in Fate, +6, you are going to wipe the floor with
anyone under that.
Yeah. Anyone who isn't legendary.
Now, you say that. I ran an earlier version of this. The Harbor City Irregulars, all D-listers, took on an A-lister and creamed them. Because that's the beauty of Fate Accelerated. Because if you have people who are designed to do support, they can create advantages for the brick in the team to then tap into and give himself a +8 if he's lucky. I have a scenario designed for the group. After running it at a convention, I realize, okay, the bad guy does not show up until Act 2. Because if he shows up in Act 1, they will cream him. You know, it's one of those things. No matter how many mooks I throw at them, they will take care of the mooks.
That is, my experience with Fate games in particular, that I love the system. I have an enormous amount of problem trying to pitch the opposition at a level that is okay, will this actually be a challenge? Smash. Okay, apparently not.
Yeah. One thing I use both henchmen and hench mooks. Basically, mooks are just mooks. They know better than a +2. Hench mooks are, they can take a consequence, a mild consequence, and they go up to +3, which puts them on par with most of the D-listers. So they're kind of even there, but they don't have as many abilities. It's coming up with their aspects has always been fun and what they're good and bad at, because it's really not well-defined in Fate what those things really, how they work. And I've been learning how those things work, so hopefully I'll be able to write this up, what I've learned in here about how to build a good mook for somebody that run against. Again, also, as a GM, you got to be willing to spend those Fate points. Tap an aspect. Just don't let them roll over you. Spend those Fate points. Mm. Just make sure your bad guy has his own personal Fate points, because you will run out.
Oh, yeah. This is the point nosedive or death spiral situation. Yes.
And, of course, that's for when you're doing two different kinds of Fate point spending. There's you, the GM, tapping someone's weakness directly. You, the NPC, tapping an aspect. So one of those, me the GM tapping something, it's infinite supply of Fate points. NPC tapping something, they got their own personal limit supply.
Interesting that you mentioned the D-list for heroes, because that does actually cut into my idea for the prompt. In an odd way.
Well, let's go in. That's enough me shelling for now. Here we go. Let's go in. Hop in. Let's hear what you got.
I'd sort of look at the Supermax Kindergarten and came on the idea that it's, rather than trying to lock up children who are master criminals, I went in the direction of the children of master criminals and supers. And there's a comic out there called Runaways, which basically has, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, the protagonists are teenagers who discover that they are the children of supervillains. And so I was sort of thinking about that, thinking about a few other comics that are out there, and ended up imagining the circumstance. You've got a world with master criminals, superheroes, supervillains. They have families, they have children, and somebody might be a supervillain, but they still love their kids, and they want the kids to be safe. And I'm imagining a circumstance where the only way that both sides could see to keep these kids from being pawns in other people's games is to set up a school, including kindergarten, that both sets of children go to. So a little bit sky high in that regard as well, that it's kind of the mutually assured destruction situation, that you've got the master criminal and crime fighter kids at the same place, because then everybody's got a vested interest in keeping that place safe.
Nice.
And the deal of superheroes comes in with who do you get to protect that? Because the really big guys are off doing stuff. So you've maybe got a group of D-list superheroes and supervillains who aren't actually very super at all.
They're kind of teacher's aides and things like that.
Yeah, you've got these people at the kindergarten. Depending on whether the thing was set up as a sort of a full-on comprehensive school or quite how you did it within on what worked scenario. But I very much like the idea of D-list supers either trying to manage increasingly more powerful than them children, or alternatively, finding themselves in the situation one day where that mutually assured destruction doctrine breaks down.
Yeah, that's sort of reminds me of it's a sequel to a book called Dreams of the Golden Age, not Dreams, After the Golden Age. It's about superheroes and their kids. Well, the Dreams of the Golden Age is about the kid of one of the kids discovering her superpowers. So it's great. Great pair of novels, along with And Soon I Will Be Invincible, which is another good one, too, about kids and dealing with supervillains and so forth. You know, children are superheroes and supervillains and things like that. Yeah. I like that.
Dealing with parental issues and superpower issues.
And deciding to get the parents angry at you and shacking up with the supervillain. Oops, spoiler! Actually, that's in the very first chapter, so it's not much of a spoiler. Yeah. it's actually in the cover blurb. So,
yeah, at that point, it's not really a spoiler if you can figure it out without ever opening the book. It's not really a spoiler; it's advertising.
Mm.
Yeah, so I can see that. And the trip with D-licious is, let's look at the Mystery Men from the movie Mystery Men.
Yep.
Imagine those guys taking care of the kids, Heaven help the kids.
Oh, heaven. That would turn into kind of a Home Alone thing pretty quickly, I think, because these children of supervillains or superheroes are probably smarter than those guys, just and more effective, just to start off with. The Shoveler would be pretty good, because he is quite a big family, but...
Yeah, yeah. He'd be the one in definitely he'd be the one in charge. And the Rage would be the one who put himself in charge of security, even though he probably is the least effective person to do so. The Invisible Boy we put in taking care of food, because that's the only thing he can do. And the Spleen? Spleen's in charge of punishment.
I don't know. I think the Spleen will get along with the kids pretty well, actually.
Nobody's entirely certain Blue Raja does, or why.
Yeah, I can see the Spleen now. Okay, kids, pull my finger.
Yes.
And the Bowler. I'm not sure what the Bowler.
The Bowler was actually fairly hardcore, just in terms of ability, to do enormous amounts of damage with a possessed bowling ball.
No. When I say the Bowler, I mean the guy in the bowling ball, the person Hamlet's daughter. Let's be honest, she didn't have any zero power. She just was able to control Dad.
those were awesome films. Yes.
Yeah, other sources. Next year there is a Disney movie coming out called Descendants, which has four of the kids of the big Disney villains. Not sure what the plot is, but that should be interesting. So, and there's also an Aaron Williams comic called PS-238, which is about a school for meta prodigies.
Yeah.
So that's kind of other sources for that.
You do got to worry about. I mean, I was of the age when I was reading through the Chris Claremont's Fantastic Four and stuff like that, and of course you just hope and pray you never get a Franklin Richards, and it probably goes right over the heads.
It's triggering something, and not in a good way. Can you mind?
Franklin Richards, for some reason, is an Omega level god.
Oh, it's Reed Richards's kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Reed Richards and Sue Richards' kid. And he basically is what they call Omega level, power level. He can basically do whatever he wants.
Wow.
That's not good in a teenager.
No, it's not good in a four-year-old either.
Oh, that's bad.
Because that's when his powers manifested.
I get a weird feeling that, from what I've been hearing lately, Reed Richards would have been a terrible dad.
Absentee father, yeah.
You ever watch The Venture Brothers?
That's where I get most of my information from, to be fair.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dear. I forgot his name was. He wasn't Mr. Fantastic. It was Mr. Something Else or Dr. Fantastic or something like that. Yeah. The Reed Richards take. That was it. They had a... come on. What's his name? The Mothman.
The Monarch?
Monarch, yes, the Monarch and Dr. Girlfriend. Mrs. Dr. Girlfriend. There was
Mrs.
an implication.
Monarch, Mrs. Monarch, yeah. No, I can't remember the full title.
Mrs. Dr. the Monarch.
Yeah, but there was a hint, then, at least in one series, that she was pregnant.
Okay.
The lifestyle of that kid. Yeah.
It's always entertaining to imagine that the Monarch would suddenly turn out, surprisingly himself, to be one of those really, really involved parents who kind of puts all the villainy on hold to just be there for the kids. And I don't know whether that would be more or less terrifying, to be honest.
Yeah.
Well, because he was abandoned as a child and raised by Monarch Butterflies, yeah. That's his backstory.
Perfectly sensible backstory for a supervillain.
makes sense. I've tried on occasions to pitch a character who was shipwrecked as a child and raised by intelligent amphibious squid. I think I almost convinced Kevin to run that game.
Venture Brothers is a show about horrible familial relationships, so maybe we should steer the boat away from that shoal.
Yeah.
So what did other people come up with for this prompt, which, judging from the handwriting, I am blaming on Kevin. Kevin's handwriting, and it sounds like Kevin's sort of idea, and it's very suspicious that it comes up after he's gotten all busy with actual paying work and not recording anymore. I'm suspicious on that score.
Well, I can let you know what I came up with.
Please.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I'm going to take it, use a standard trope name. It's what it says in the tin. Supermax Kindergarten for all the master criminal children. It is in fact a Supermax prison, and these are super villain children. I mean, you know, they're not children of supervillains. They're children who are supervillains. All, you know, all between the ages of, you know, 4 and 5. Yeah. You have the mastermind, the little kid who's 4 years old and is in his abnormally shaped head for this enormous brain, and he's Dr. Furious, you know, and he actually has a doctorate. He got it when he was 3.
All of the power and none of the self-control.
Oh, yeah. They're all the happy little sociopaths. You have the kid, you know, who's 2 meters tall, 1 meter wide, weighs 200 kilograms, and has the brains and attitudes of a 4-year-old.
Which is perfectly fine for a 4-year-old, except for the whole destructive capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, Baby Hulk is something you don't take off. And they're there because you don't put people in prison unless they commit crimes. So every one of these kids has committed a crime. You know, they've gone out and they've robbed a bank, or more likely robbed a candy store or a toy store, you know, with their superpowers, because they're kids. They really don't understand money yet. Even though Dr. Furious has written a paper on the quantum properties of wave motion guns, he does not understand what money is yet.
On that basis, he might have a PhD in macroeconomics.
Yeah, that too. And the reason why they're being put into a kindergarten is that they're still children, and we still have a chance to, and I hate to use rehabilitate because that's one assumes that they were good people before.
Rehabilitate.
To basically try to make them good people. And if you know your tropes, you cannot force them to be good people, because we all know that never works. You know, even a guy who can do psychic surgery and rewrite their brains so they're good people, you still have to do that initial scan of what the brain looked like ahead before, and it's still stored someplace, and they can always find it and put it back. And their memories
stress, and it reemerges. Yeah,
Or they remember what it was like before they had the surgery.
Yeah.
Or someone wishes it away, or whatever. It can always be undone.
Redemption must be earned.
It must be from within. So yes, the kids have to learn. So the teacher, I can keep my name for her, Miss Abigail Crabtree. That's really reaching back into the past, and you folks probably don't get it whatsoever.
Nope. Not even slightly.
Yeah. Okay. Because I have to go way back. Now, I'll let you folks know, I was born in 1960, so I'm in my 50s. You know, I'm the old guy around here. And as a kid, we used to watch, you know, when we were watching TV, they would show some of the old serials from the movies, and one of them was The Little Rascals, which couldn't probably be shown today to children without causing a ruckus.
Context would have to be established.
Yes, but their teacher was named Mrs. Crabtree. And she was played by a little blonde ingenue, eye candy for the parents. That's where her name came from. But yeah, she's a perfectly normal, non-superpowered person. She's in her 30s. She's got a degree in sociology, teaching, and criminal law.
Yeah. Handy.
And it's her job to start teaching these kids things like sharing is good. And giving is even better. You know, not giving punches or using your mind control to make people give you stuff. No. Yeah. You got baby Dr. Xavier in here too.
Whoever said Dr. Magneto is gonna be a problem.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. And, well, the thing is maybe not, because this is being a super prison, you don't let them run around with their superpowers. If you ever looked at the Rikers in any of the old Marvel comics, they all had various suppressors or adamantium cuffs to put them in various things so they couldn't use their powers. So imagine these kids have suppressor bracelets, or for like some, they have adamantium cuffs, so they actually can't, and with chains, they can't lift too high, so they can't have your arms above themselves to come back down and break your head. You know, they're done like this. And then I had to debate, okay, and what about their parents? Are they in the equivalent of juvie home, or are the parents there also? Because, you know, we want to have a nurturing environment, which means you got to bring the parents in. But if you bring the parents in, are they also villains? Are they just regular criminals, or are they just normals whose child got out of their hands, so to speak?
I was thinking a mixture of all of those would be entertaining. Yeah. So you have the perfectly normal parents visiting Junior Hulk. You have Megamind's parents with their giant heads visiting on a supervised visit. So all of them are wearing adamantian shackles and everything. These guys are on a supervised visit, having transferred across from the Permax door.
Oh yeah, yeah. In my universe, the Supermax prison for the really dangerous guys is at 500 feet under the middle of the Antarctic ice sheet.
Nice.
We're keeping them on ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, if I've ever met role players, if they're playing these kids, their objective is going to be break out. That is the go-to story. Unless you're actually telling a story about them gaining their redemption or finding a way to grow up and live productively in society.
That's a good one. Like I said, in this case, I would use a system like Fate Accelerated for the game, or my Harbor City version. They would all be listed as D-listers because they're really, they're still kids. They really haven't hit full stride yet, even though one of them can bend bars with his bare hands. They're still kids. And they're not up there yet. At the very least, someone will be a C-lister at best. But most of them are just kids between 4 and 5 years old. And what I would do is, in creating them, I would say, okay, we need to give them some background. Let's take a tip of the hat from Sotsy and do the 5-chapter thing. Oh. Chapter 1, your birth and your parents. So we know what your home life was. Chapter 2, powers emerge. Chapter 3, super villain team up with the person on your right. Chapter 4, supervillain team up with the person on the other side. And 5, busted.
It all goes horribly wrong.
This way, you have a connection with the other player, with at least 2 other players, and now everyone has some background on you, and your aspects sort of will reflect it, because each one of these chapters you'll derive an aspect from, like your high concept, your weakness, and the other 3 aspects. You have these 5 aspects that are all sort of kind of linked, and you'll have a connection to the other players because of this backstory. And now, as you said, it depends if I'm going to be doing a one-shot or a campaign. If I'm doing a one-shot, I would do the adventure of basically at least an A-level or an A-lister or a legendary villain comes to Supermax, and he's after the MacGuffinite. And it happens to be that Miss Crabtree knows where the MacGuffinite is. And now it's up to the class to try to do something about this, even though they start out being shackled.
Right. Okay, I get it. Yep.
Well, also because the A-lister comes in and goes, oh, go away, go play with your blocks, leave me alone, go away, poo, 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 change your diapers, you little boogers.
Yeah. It reminds me of a Star Trek Next Generation episode where a few members of the core crew ended up being turned kids back into teenagers of plot. Then the ship gets taken over, and so you have this teenager and younger crew taking back the ship using raw cunning because they sure as hell don't have any other option.
Was it Next Generation?
I think it was Next Generation because you had a junior Picard. They managed to find a kid
who looked
an awful lot like an incredibly young B. Goldberg.
Uh-huh.
And they had a kid playing Worf's son.
Yeah.
It went pretty well. So you had the teenage Picard pretending to be the annoying brat son of Will Riker.
I would definitely would have ties, if it's one child, I would definitely have ties to the teacher so that they have reasons to, like her, because one, she helps the kids get, privileges and stuff like that and toys and things, and therefore they have a reason why they want to keep her around. And if they don't do something, they may actually get a teacher who just treats them like, little criminals.
Mm. Yeah. And I like the idea that while they'd normally be all scheming to break out, this interloper comes in and they have to restore the status quo so they can go back to scheming to break out.
Yeah. Now as doing a longer-term game, now this longer-term game would be different then. Longer-term game would be actually seeing if they could be convinced to be, good guys. Use your powers for good. And that actually sort of ties into the progression system in Fate, where, you know, they're eventually looking for that major milestone where they can rewrite their high concept and have the permission through, you know, through events that happened in the past to maybe write from, you know, I am evil incarnate to I really don't like other people that much.
Right. Step it through a number of processes to...
Baby steps, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Of course, there'd be the session where they go against Little Miss Goody Two Shoes home for the meta-human children. You know, so here's it's supervillains, and here comes the little snots. There's Jor-El Jr., there's, you know, Wayne Jr. coming over for a play date.
Oh, yes.
If such a thing was published for the campaign, calling it Baby Steps would...
Oh, that would be a perfect name for it. Yeah. Baby Steps. Okay, oh. Notes. Where's my notes? Okay.
Another point of reference would be Judd Winnick's Barry Ween Boy Genius comics. He's a bit older. He's like tween age, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, as far as incredibly dangerous short people go.
Yeah.
Actually reminds me, because she did this for a short period of time with the Avengers. You would probably have to have someone to watch over the kids besides the teacher. So you need a super, like you said, you need a D-lister, or you need somebody who basically they can't hurt. Squirrel Girl.
True. She has never been defeated.
She defeated Galacticus.
And she's full of energy, so that's got to be good when running around after kids. So
yeah, and her squirrels would keep track of everyone, of all the kids, you know. So
she would make a good substitute teacher.
Yeah. Yeah. The teacher that cannot control the class.
We've all had that substitute teacher in our past.
Yeah. And the kids decide, can we make Squirrel Girl cry? They make it their mission, make her cry. And then they feel really bad when they do it. Because what you have to do to make Squirrel... from my familiarity with the character, you really would have to do something horrendous to make her cry. And then you feel bad about it. Yeah, everyone gets a mild consequence. You feel bad.
I like it.
That sounds like a fun idea.
So, what about yours?
I was going to bounce mine off another pop culture property, the 90s cartoon Rugrats.
Oh,
where the world is observed in all its crazy 90s-ness through the eyes of small children. And I was wondering if recasting that, often they would run situations and they would try and interpret them probably through the lens of something they'd seen on television, and it would become kind of this sort of fantasy world. And I was wondering if just like a simple short game where you have the inmates of the kindergarten basically attempting to break out as though this was a high security, colded style prison, with the warden and the guards and so forth. But they've just decided that it is basically dressed up in their imaginations. It's actually pretty normal, but the idea is to go through and describe the events and the place as though they're interpreting it in this way.
That also reminds me of Muppet Babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where they would, you know, go a lot more literal in that aspect of the imagination. But yeah, because both work. I mean, I've watched some Rugrats and I watched Muppet Babies, and yeah, both of those would be a good jumping off point. Yeah. So are they really super villains, or are they just kids thinking they're super villains?
I would go with they're just kids, but they're doing things that in their minds they are. So the idea is you get to describe the scenario, what the kid's actually attempting to do, and what they think they are doing, how they feel this works in the real world, and actually do that to affect their plan. Maybe not an escape per se, but say they've decided they want to break into the staff room and retrieve something, or they've had their favorite toys confiscated, and they're going to do this daring raid. Yep.
Or they see a teacher bring in a bag of Oreos, and then they see her that she's put it up on the top shelf.
Nice.
Then in real life, there's four of the little kids with some extension cords tied around the little fat kid and lowering him down from the air vent. But in their mind, it's Mission Impossible and the zip lines.
Yep. And it works as well as it works in the fantasy, which is the conceit. They're getting away with these things, which would be horrifically dangerous or just very silly. in real life, but this force of the collective imagination is propelling them through this little journey.
I'm liking the idea that the things like the old electric eye has somebody gone through the doorway into the office center becomes the fearsome red laser grid to be squirmed under and this kind of thing.
I'm trying to remember. It's a role-playing game. You're playing Space Marines. It's like 314 or something like that. Or
316 Carnage of Stars?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It's really unplayable. We had fun with it when my friends was running it. And the more we played it, the more we start realizing the system was just insane. And we decided, you know what? Yeah. And we ends up being that instead of being Space Marines, we're all inmates in a prison. You know, inmates in an insane asylum, but we're being questioned because somewhere in the town, we've hidden a dirty bomb.
Right.
But it sort of plays out. What we were seeing in our collective imaginations was not exactly what was going on in the real world. I can say for a fact that does sort of work, especially if you started out not telling them what the reality is, but let them find out what reality is as they go along. It's sort of like the Better Than Life scenario with Red Dwarf. Is this reality, or which is reality? Are we really supervillain kids, or are we kids who think we're supervillains?
I know there was a game, I never got to play it. It was a very odd game done by, I think, Complectic Psychosis, which started with the premise that all of the players are wildly hallucinating, and they're surrounded by people who want stuff from them, but what's going on is at least initially blocked from them. As I understand it, the goal of the game was to effectively figure out what was actually happening to what your eyes and you were telling you.
Oh, you're okay. I should also be called free association man too, because I just realized another game setting you could use that would be very twisted. Don't rest your head.
Yes.
Don't rest your head. Kindergarten edition, please.
Yeah. I don't know if you can do the supervillains, but, you know, it would end up being supervillains in the dream world, yeah.
That's quite dark.
Yeah. It'd be totally appropriate, though, for the setting, though. It really is driven by the power of the mind, and who's got the best imaginations? Kids!
Yeah.
Terrifying minds.
Oh,
ooh,
but yeah.
That would be a good one to try to get onto the event schedule at Gen Con. Hey, don't rest your head, you're playing kids. What?
You're playing 4 and 5 year olds, in fact.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I am reminded of Squee from Johnny the Homicidal Maniac.
Oh, yeah.
That, or if you don't want to use Doris your head, you can also use a variation of Urchin.
That one I don't know. What's Urchin?
It's a role-playing game that was based on a movie that was illegally filmed in New York. and it's crazy. It's a crazy game where you're basically you're homeless people, but you're trying to find some paradise. And you're basically, during the day, you're trying to get money from people or food or stuff to make drugs. And then someone's got to pay for the light at night. Otherwise, bad things come and hurt you. And it's very random. And the character sheets are usually written on pieces of garbage. In fact, the rules say you dig garbage out of a can. You find something that's usable and fairly clean. Use that for your character sheet.
Oh, is this when you write your equipment list by writing the things you don't have?
No, you don't even have equipment. You basically just got meat and brains, I think it is. Not a whole lot of that. And it's one of those nasty death spiral games where when you start losing, you just keep on losing.
So it's like the Fisher King, but probably less happy ending.
It can be a happy ending if you actually can make it to the promised land.
If. Yes. The operative word, I think, yeah.
In the half dozen times we played it, at least I played it, it only happened once.
Right.
Yeah.
There are going to be so many show notes.
Oh, the last one wasn't a piker.
Yeah, that last one wasn't too bad. It seemed to go in waves. Yeah, I mean, with the Elvis one, it was kind of a, well, you could link specific Elvis things, or it's just a, here is a link to the Wikipedia page on Elvis Presley. Pretty much most of it's there.
Well, you didn't know about Marcus Rowland's Once and Future King.
I knew about the Diana.
Diana, Warrior Princess.
Yes. Knew about that one. I didn't know about the Elvis add-on supplement for it.
Yeah. And it even has a section of Elvis impersonators. For those of you not familiar, Diana Warrior Princess was written during the height of the Xena craze. And the premise is, it's now 2,000 years, 3,000 years, 4,000 years in the future, and someone's writing a role-playing game about now. And how you have Diana, Warrior Princess, versus the evil Queen Mother. Things like that. It's the 20th century, 21st century viewed from 4,000 years from now. People who are not contemporary are now contemporary.
Yep.
Like Julius Caesar and Xena.
Having looked at the cover art, I strongly suspect the picture of Margaret Thatcher, who has three superpowers.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's
surprised. Yeah, with the number of links in this show, I am very glad that it's Ben's turn.
Yeah.
At least I think that's the case, yes, Matt?
Considering you're turning up for going to Gen Con, I might be doing the editing as well, just so you have the opportunity to follow those incredibly precise lists of yours without going insane.
Yeah, my travelling process is most efficient.
It's very thorough, and having seen other people's travelling processes, you've got to appreciate that.
Yeah. Oh, just going to ask you, you're not going to have a floor costume, are you? Or
no, I'm not really a costumey person anyway, but just the logistics of trying to transport something to New Zealand.
Yeah.
I did get curious at one point because in my working life, I'm a map maker for an engineering company. And so I got curious a while ago as to where is the person who traveled the furthest to go to Gen from? Because I was pretty sure they weren't from New Zealand, but I wanted to know where basically the antipodes of Indianapolis are. And it turns out whoever traveled the furthest to Gen Con, sort of great circle distance, is probably Australian, probably came from Perth. I don't know if this person exists, because Gen Con doesn't publish that kind of information, but I know there's at least one guy from the east coast of Australia who travels further than I do.
Well, you mentioned maps. There is actually a Google group run, of course, by my friend Sophie, called Map Making Games. It is a cornucopia of maps for gaming. And people have maps in there. There's two others. There's 5-minute maps where the challenge is you set yourself a timer. You have 5 minutes. Here's the theme. Hit the timer. Now draw a map for the theme.
Nice.
No cheating.
I made a note. I will look that one up. Yes. The vast majority of my work over the last 9 years has been on very large infrastructure projects that nobody builds.
Ah.
It's an interesting field, but...
yes, my collection of imaginary dams.
Yep, I've got three imaginary dams, an imaginary road, at least one imaginary mass transit system, though that one they may actually be building.
I remember trying to come up with a game that involved a bridge. But it was no ordinary bridge. This is a war game. So the bridge had to be huge, multi-level, spanning across a mile. And it was half a mile wide.
I'm kind of imagining the bridges people have built on.
Mm-hmm.
That kind this was of setup.
The architecture from Judge Dredd, where everything is bigger.
Yeah, it'd be more Judge Dredd. It was actually more sci-fi. I can't remember. It was either across the bridge or the bridge was defending itself. Very important bridge, of course. Oh, geez, when was that? When I was 16 years old when I came up with the idea. Oh, wow. And I soon realized there's no way to defend it. If the enemy is serious about taking that bridge out, they will take the bridge out.
You need to have a reason that they keep the bridge undamaged.
Yeah.
You have to take, yeah.
Yeah, you have to give them a reason that they want the bridge intact. But then you have the inverse question. Okay, if I can't have the bridge, neither can you.
Yeah. That does more of a problem.
Yeah, so you have to set up such that no one wants to destroy the bridge. But in that case, why are you having a war over it then? The scenario sort of dies at that point. Mm. You know, when you realize the only way to make it possible that no one will destroy the bridge is that both sides need it. But if both sides need it, can't they find a better way of doing this besides killing each other? Well, if you look at our history, the answer is no, of course not.
Historically, no. We've found plenty of reasons to kill each other when better off.
I've read too much Terry Pratchett. Yeah.
Well, shall we call it at this point? I think we've certainly kicked the Supermax kindergarten around.
Even though some of the kids could probably kick us around. It's funny.
And we've kicked Tritac and Friendworthy around a fair bit. It has been awesome. Yes, when listening to somebody's actual play, you get a very narrow slice of what the game's about. So it's kind of nice to hear it from somebody who's got that step back perspective.
I have 40 hours of recorded playtests, which will never get released because I'm not going to sit down and try to edit damn things.
You're not going to release them as a you know, playtesting raw and unedited.
I would not inflict it on anybody, considering that we had several of them. We had really bad connections, so you go later, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Playtest at half of his weight. What was that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or the robot voice.
Oh, well, thank you very much for coming on to the show.
Oh, yeah.
And
thank you for inviting me.
Most welcome. We like having guests.
One of these days, you should probably see if we can get both me and Taz on. We can tag team.
That would be entertaining. Yeah. And he'd probably be up for it.
Yeah. Oh, I should think of at least one last pitch before we go. So something to think on. One last pitch. The Dashan Warriors of the Veldt.
Dashan Warriors of the Veldt. All right. And on that note, dear audience, we shall bid you good night.
Thank you.
Isn't that me? Good night.
Next time on the Big Red Couch.
Hi, folks. I salute your perseverance for having made it this far. This episode drops on the weekend that Gen Con is on, and Craig's in attendance, so we're going to try and catch up with him for a Gen Con debrief, either on the last day or when he returns. So either way, our show in a fortnight's time is going to be full of sleep-deprived rambling and regrets. So let us all look forward to that. Take care, everybody.
Want to hear more of our shenanigans? Then go to hoarde.net and click on the button that looks like a couch. The Big Red Couch is released under Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 3.0 Unported from creativecommons.org. All music on the show comes from the album Universal Fluff Theory by Krakatoa. Visit them at krakatoa.com or follow the link from our page. See you next time!